We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep. The poor and the underclass are growing. Racial justice and human rights are non-existent. We have been lulled into a trance. They have made us indifferent to ourselves, to others. We are focused only on our own gain. That is their primary method of survival. Keep us asleep, keep us selfish, keep us sedated.
You're listening to Toward Anarchy on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Here's your host, Michael Storm.
Storm, and as always, it is so great to get to come together as we do when we do it. I appreciate you taking the time to spend with me. It really is valuable to me, and I think it's important. And there's a lot to talk about today. So much to talk about today, in fact, that before it's over, we will have used both hours of network time. That's not something that I generally do anymore. So this will be, if you're not listening to the network, there's a second part to this that may not be immediately right there attached to it, that just doesn't flow after the next commercial break, as it were. You might have to go and look for it, or maybe you're caught in the second part of it and you want to go back and catch the first part of it. And trust me, I looked at it before I got into it thinking, oh yeah, I can do this. I can knock this out real quick in an hour, no problem, because, you know, what's stopping me, right? It's just me and 57 pages of information for me to peruse through and consider and then convey a message to some folks who are listening, such as yourself. And I figured, yeah, sure, in a 57, 30, 50, 58 seconds, whatever, it's somewhere around 57, 58 minutes in each of the hours based on the network timing that I'd be able to knock it out and have 20 minutes to just chat about whatever I wanted to. No, not even the case, because there's a lot to consider in there, and I think it's an important conversation, and why would I limit it when I don't have to? That really is what it comes down to. So we'll jump right into the conversation. I'll tell you what the conversation is in just a second. Do me a favor real quick, though, wherever you're finding me at today, click that like button. Do it now. If you don't do it now, you won't do it later, because you'll be into the conversation. You'll be arguing with me. You'll be telling me I'm an idiot and that doesn't make any sense. And I'll be saying, well, it's not my, I didn't say it. Well, maybe I did say it. We'll get there. You'll forget about it. So click that like button now. I appreciate it. Truly, it's the biggest thing that you can do other than, you know, sort of donate your money to me, which I don't even have a function for doing that, although it's in the works. I'm finally breaking it out. You know, I organized as a business, and so I have certain expenditures now, and then I have to play around with these little tax numbers and things like that, and so I'm paying for more things for the business. I have those check marks next to my name so that you know it's me on the social media, some things like that that are ultimately business write-offs, because I otherwise wouldn't care. You know, that check mark is there because I'm wanting the people that I'm talking to come in and know that it's me. So that's coming. It's in the future. But now, just click the like button. Subscribe, follow along at Toward Anarchy on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and X. That's about it, really. There are other places around there. But if it's not at Toward Anarchy, it's probably not me. And of course, you can always visit towardanarchy.com. I'm always there. Everything I do is there. It goes up there, and it's the record. You can't dispute the record. It's right there for everyone. Episode 2630 will be this one. Let me tell you about it. So I'm really looking forward to this. I've been looking forward to this for a while, and I've been looking specifically this for a while. But in general, things like this don't happen to me very often, and that's why I'm really excited about it. Because if you know me, you listen to the show over the years, you've heard me talk about it. The reality reality is that I pride myself in the fact that my understanding of the world comes from experience and observation and a very little bit of spending time reading or finding out what other people think about the world. Conversationally, absolutely, but have I spent any time reading any of the great philosophers, the great anarchists? I don't even know if that's a thing. Proudhon, there's names out there, but I don't really know who these people are. I don't know necessarily when they existed in time or what their contribution to these things are. And it's true with the my opinions. They're not opinions, they're facts. They're observable facts. That's the reason that I accept them as they are. Regarding economics and regarding the law, these things are observable facts, and they fit with a certain worldview that I've held long before I knew any of these people's names. These are views that I've held fundamentally since I was a teenager, very young, 12, 13 years old, right in those early formative years, understanding that I am who I am today, basically the same person that I was then in my understanding of and how I deal with the world and the things that I enjoy in the world, too. I never lost my vigor for youth and for learning, but I just chose to do it all in different ways. When it came to learning about life and about the things that happen in life, as opposed to read about them or the philosophies, learning the philosophies about them, I just went out and lived life. And I started at a really young age, and I cut myself from all the bonds of other people's opinions, from religion to social to political, across the board, and learned about this world myself. Excuse me. Let me get some of my drink here. And of course, I pride myself in that, because you can't look at any of the things that I've said over the years, the opinions that I've had about our reality, and suggest that they are the opinions of somebody else, that I did not form these opinions myself. And so it's really cool for me to get to look at something that is considered a big part of this existence that I have in terms of learning from the scholastic aspect of it. I've talked many times about the difference between the functional aspect of my reality and our reality and what I've chosen to do functionally to live my life versus what a lot of other people do academically, sitting there and sort of observing the world and making their opinions about it. And participating in it too, but that's the academic portion of it, right? That's for those people who are attempting to, you know, make a particular point, whereas I believe my points to be self-evident, right? The things that I talk about are self-evident. They're in the actions of people. They're in the responses of people. They're in the study. They're in the science. They're in all of these realities. They're based in grounded information as opposed to supposition, fear, regard to or for or against any particular political or social ideology, other than obviously I was born an individual, free. I owe nothing to anyone except maybe mom, possibly dad. That's debatable, certainly by individual, and certainly after a certain point in life. I'm in my 50s now. I've been responsible for who I am for a very long time. That's what I mean, like 40 years. I've been this person. Before that, I was, you know, mom's person or grandma's person or whoever. I was a child being raised. But about the age of 12, all of that changed, right at the time of middle school, right at the time of being already past the basics of what school and public education is going to teach you. So finding a disconnect there. Being told that socially you're supposed to be a certain way, finding the disconnect there by meeting the people socially that they're saying you shouldn't be like and realizing, wow, these are just fantastic people. Participating in the pop culture that is demonized by one group or another, political, social, religious, what have you, and separating myself from the those things. So coming back full circle at the age of 53 to read something that everybody else would say would be core to my understanding, what I would need to have read it to have the understanding that I have about life, is kind of fun. So I read Anatomy of the State. I read it like 3 o'clock this morning and was making some notes on it. And that's Murray N. Rothbard. I don't know who Murray N. Rothbard is. I know the name. I'm not trying to convince you that I'm completely ignorant of any of this stuff. That's never been the case. I know who these people are relatively. And I know of a number of their various works and things because people often cite them, not because I've read them. I've tried. I tried to read Crisis and Leviathan. It's Mises. And I picked up Man, the Economy and State once, and I think that's Rothbard. That's his attempt to reduce human action to something a little bit more palatable for the average person. His attempt at Austrian economics for dummies, I guess, and Mises' human action. But see, the reason that I understand these things is very little influence, but in the very nature of what these things represent. Mises' human action is literally suggesting that economics is something, that economic transactions are something that we are always doing, that everything we do is an economic transaction in one form or another, that we are giving up some currency of our own, mostly time, that we don't know how much of it we have, for some return, some reward, some trinket, whatever it happens to be, and that these things are obvious, and that the only reason that these things generally work is through voluntary cooperation, and that as soon as you leave the area of voluntary cooperation, you get into the area of manipulation, and then you have to start wondering why and who it's for, cui bono, right? Who benefits? And so these things were all self-evident to me in the definition of praxeology. It's the study of human action. The study of human action, what? There's a lot of human actions. Oh, the study of human action in relation to the resolution of their wants and needs and their own limitation. This is the long, my own words. All this is my own words, unless there's one quote I'll get to here that kicks it all off. But this is all my presentation, and this is all about really understanding that these things are inherently, that these things are of value, and that they are truthful, and they represent what is observable fact about our world and the needs and wants of people and how they will resolve them and what tools they will use to resolve them depending on what tools are in their little toolkit. And that's just me. That's just being separated from everything, including my parents and my home. By the time I hit my early teens, by the time I was 14, I was out of the house. I had been on the streets, not living on the streets or anything. I never did that. But I played on the streets. I stayed on the streets. I was out there all day, all night. I ran with the people on the streets. I just didn't sleep there on the streets. I always went home. I had a home, relatively stable home in that sense, until my mother got married right around, the time I turned 12, somewhere right around there. And then the tension shifts and things. But already I'm on my own at this point anyway. I've already made my own decisions about the things that I'm going to participate in because I've seen them with my own eyes. And so I am who I am, and I understand these things innately. And so I've never argued with, and I've never had to go through and read necessarily any or all of these big texts and tomes about what economics is, what about the law, what the law is, what any of these major contributing factors to our society, the manipulations of them through force and coercion, and how they're built up and propped up, and it's obvious to me. I see it. I'm a puzzle solving guy. It's interesting. If you follow along, you'll know that we take care of my wife's aging father, and he is almost 80 years old now at this point, basically, and he's not great. He has sundowners in a massive way, and we're doing all the things that you can, you know, clocks and things like that, and sort of talk downs and reassurances and trying to keep him on a schedule and do all these things. And so there's this thing that we're sort of coming along and learning, and it's dropping all of these different realities about life into our lap, and how we deal with them and how we accept them from one minute to the next, and how you just have to accept certain realities. And it's interesting with the old guy, how he's just sort of slipping away a little bit, and it, you know, he's not always able to grasp the conversation, and how he puts together he sees the world in such a different way that I have to interpret things, or we have to try to figure out what it is that he's trying to say. And there are so many examples of this, but there's a interesting one that just happened just the other day. So it's been really wet and it's been really hot here, and so it's kind of tough to get to the yard. And he's always been one of these guys that, oh, the yard has to be clipped and it has to be trimmed. And so I've been out there when I can, dealing with the overgrown yard and the trees and the bushes from the back alley and things that aren't ours, really. The yard itself, other than the grass not being mowed recently, is fine. We keep our stuff. It's the stuff that's coming over the fence and into our space. And I cut some pieces, and one big piece didn't come down. And so I hadn't had a chance to cut it all up and get it lined up and sort of out of the yard and out of his view, because he goes out and sits on the back porch and smokes cigars. And his day consists of, I don't know who the lady is, but there's a you know, sort of TikTok famous or Reels famous, you know, YouTube famous person who's dealing with, has dealt with these older patients. And they talk, and she talks about, I don't know if it's original or her or whatever, but she talks about how they get up in the morning and they have these spoons. They have a number of spoons, and really it's just energy. It's a way to account for what they can get through the day. And so they say you have seven spoons. Well, getting up and getting dressed, there's one spoon out the door. You know, getting into the bathroom and taking care of those things, there's another spoon. Breakfast is another spoon. By the time you're getting around to midday, you're kind of out of spoons, especially if you go have a cigar, if you make a drink, you do any of these other things. You get a phone call or a bunch of scammers trying to call and repeatedly calling the phone over and over again, something that breaks your concentration, can't get logged into your bank account, it costs a spoon, and you run out of spoons, and so you're out of these things by the end of the day. And it's as good a representation, it's as good a way as any to speak about the expenditure of energy. But it's just funny, the solving the puzzles is what I'm getting at, and how I'm able to come to the conclusions that I do because of problem solving, puzzle solving, being able to put pieces together. And so there's this new tree branch in the back of the yard, and at the same time this happened, we had a little bit of a flooding incident here in the basement, and we have a path, these rubber mats. They're like workout mats, basically, and they make a path through the sort of the concrete part into the space where we're at, where it's all carpeted and nice and the TV is and the computer and all that stuff, into our living space, is through the, I guess, the storage space, whatever. The whole thing used to be finished at one point, but and at any rate, some water had made it in through there, and we had to get that cleaned up, and it made it far enough that it made it a little bit under our mats. And so it's just sort of the nature of the dirty water coming across the floor, that sort of thing, coming in through the outside and across the floor, and just people walking across these mats all the time, just made them kind of dirty, kind of almost a muddy mess. And so I picked all the mats up, and they're in these individual little squares, little 2-foot by 2-foot squares that you piece together like a puzzle, right? And so I take them, and I just throw them out in the rain, because it's raining at the time. I just throw them out in the rain on the deck. We have a big open wooden deck that a pool, an above-ground pool used to reside on. And so there's all this open space. And so I took all of the squares And I put them all out there individually and just sort of let the rain wash them off. And I just kind of left them out there and hadn't brought them in yet. And we're listening to him tell us a story. Well, my wife is. She's talking to him. He's sitting out on the back porch. And he points out the tree branch over there, the new branch that fell, that should have fallen before but finally fell because of the storm. And I haven't got out there to cut it up yet, so it's just kind of out there at the back of the yard, and he can see it, and the leaves have turned a little yellow because it's been a couple of days, and it's been really, really hot, and it was already disconnected anyway. I had already cut it. It just hadn't fallen. And he sees it out there, and he says something about, yeah, you see the tree out there. It was pretty crazy. I was just watching it, and these squares started to come out of it. And I don't know what it was, but it just started spitting out these squares. And my wife didn't think anything of it, and she came and told me and said something about it. And I said, well, it's him. Right, he always wants the yard clean. He wants the stuff done, but he can't reconcile that because of his inability to go do it himself. For one thing, he has all day to think about it. He's out of spoons. All of these things contributing to his what he's seeing back there is a branch that fell down, and then all of a sudden there's these weird squares over here that he has no idea where they came from. He doesn't even know what they are. No clue. His brain has no concept of what they are because he's probably never even seen one before. And even if he had, it was so long ago and in his brain and his aging that he couldn't, you know, it takes something to drag it out of him, you know, pointing it out and clarifying the situation. But she's telling me about this later, and I immediately think of it. Well, he's thinking that crazy tree out there that needs to go away, that branch, it's one little branch really, that just needs to go away. It shouldn't be there. The yard should be clean. That branch shouldn't be there. And all of a sudden, these squares are over here because they have to be related. And it's just me sort of solving it. And that's only one example of many that we've come across as his memory and everything has continued to degrade. And the sundowners is taking more effect, and you start getting into the questions of dementia and things like that. So at any rate, all right, that was just a really fun, long way to tell you about the fact that I just kind of put pieces together, and it's really not that complicated as long as you're looking at the pieces and you're reviewing them for how they fit with the other pieces, and that's all I've ever done on any of this. So I didn't know who Murray Rothbard was. I've never read Anatomy of the State. I did know that with the assumptions, I'll lay it out for you, the assumptions going in. I know he's an economist. I know that he's an Austrian school economist. I know that he has direct ties to Mises himself, Ludwig von Mises, the father of the Austrian school. I've never read anything by Rothbard other than quotes. I did pick up Man, the Economy, and the State one time. I read about two or three chapters, maybe. I didn't know. It probably wasn't even chapters. It was the same with Crisis and Leviathan. These things are just big tomes, and I just don't care because almost none of it matters in terms of the simplified explanation and understanding of human action praxeology. It's the deeper look at how you manage a larger economy, or how you might if you had to manage an economy, as it were, politically, socially, however, other than just the simple basics of how money functions, how people function. And so I've never read anything by him other than some quotes and maybe a little bit here out of one of these bigger tomes of theirs. And I tried. I legitimately tried. This was in my early 20s. I legitimately tried. I was in a group, a libertarian Austrian group that met once a month, and we would read these books, and I just wouldn't read them. They would read them, and I just didn't care because I started reading them, and they're talking about managing money supply and things like this, and none of that matters for the message that I need to convey. And it's not that if I could if just like the rest of it, that you couldn't lay out for me one argument or another from any given school, and I would give you the same reasoned and based on the same reasoning response. And that's why I accept the Austrian school. I believe it's the only economic theory that is supportive of the individual and concentrates on the importance of the individual and their choices in the markets and in our reality, both socially and politically. And it says a lot about it. There's no question about it, but I haven't read that much about it. I just get it from the idea of piecing the puzzle together and the obvious truth of human action versus what is obviously the difference between currency and money and all these things. So it's really just a simple puzzle to put together if you want to take the time to do it. I just gathered ultimately that all of these guys, Mises, Rothbard, there's some others in there, John Locke, obviously way back, many, many others that are Adam Smith, that are all associated with some good, Milton Friedman. These are all names that I know, but I don't know their papers. Every once in a while over the years, I've read one thing or another by them, no more than like pamphlets like this. And so I don't consider it to be very hard, and that's why I like to talk about it. And it's rewarding to pick up something like this, know what you know about the person and the ideas that they're talking about, and believe, and having believed it to be a certain way, be confirmed that it is a certain way, that these things are not just as I see them, but they are arguments that other people have been making for a long time, and I've found my own way to make them without knowing how they made their arguments. It's a fantastic thing. It's wonderful for me, and I think it would be wonderful for any free-thinking individual to realize that, as opposed to having spent so much time academically in life, as opposed to just living life, my choice. So I didn't know who he was, and went and found out a little bit about him. He went to Columbia. He was into math and economics at one point early on, 20s. Something like that, early on, possibly still in college. He bumped into the Foundation for Economic Education, and from there, von Mises himself. And apparently he's one of these people who could sit through human action. I couldn't. It wasn't going to happen. I got it. You gave me the definition. It makes perfect sense. Thank you. I don't need the details. I'll figure the rest out on my own. Great philosophy. I'm moving on with life. Forever then a champion, I suppose, of praxeology and that study of human action. And so I got it by definition and just really accepted it as pretty much carte blanche. There's nothing that I've heard really come out of those schools or these people in general that suggests that they were absolutely wrong about their ideologies and their understanding of economics and politics. Certainly not by my own estimation, and certainly not by the proof in reading this. I went in with some assumptions, and those were them. And so I really didn't expect to find anything in particular incompatible with anarchism, with my own understanding of these things. The Austrian school, again, it's the only sort of individual liberty-friendly economic system because it's not a system. It's based on observation. It's based on human action, and it's based on understanding what humans will and can do given our environment and the basics of our environment and how we can manipulate it or the individual tools that we have to manipulate it and those as currency and time as currency and how we will use those things to resolve our needs and wants by doing what we do best and then freely out there in the market exchanging with other people, preferably without a third party. These are all basic things. They all make perfect sense to me, and they're all contained within this observable human action, that every transaction is an economic transaction, that time is our most valuable currency. So he starts off with the quote, the greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism, says Murray N. Rothbard to open Anatomy of the State, this little 57-page pamphlet. And he begins by telling us after the quote what the state isn't, is what the state is not. And I think that's a way a lot of people start out when they're trying to explain simple ideas that seem complicated. You start by explaining what it isn't. And it's not we, he says. We are not the government. The government is not us. Yeah, this is a thing that is generally supposed to be understood by the population, but it's really not. He suggests that most people view the state as necessary and that it's counter to evil market forces or evil criminal forces, which, again, are still market forces in their own way, because they're all, again, an expenditure. They're all an economic expenditure. Even crime is. And that ultimately that things like democracy over time have obfuscated the true nature of the state, because the state has gone through various forms over the centuries, and, you know, from various small dictatorships to larger dictatorships to socialist dictatorships to less socialist dictatorships to democratic socialist dictatorships like we have now. Don't kid yourself. It's always been that way. Democracy is, of course, nothing but socialist, a socialist endeavor. Government is nothing but a socialist endeavor. And I think I've told you that many, many times over the years. And I think that this book, it goes through its in its short way in an attempt to prove that. A democracy has just destroyed it's covered up the true nature of this state through the illusion of participation. It's the erroneous idea that we the people are in charge of the government, and so it must follow that the actions and the dictates of government, everything that it does, must be politically and socially just and justified, right? We've talked about this a lot over the years, and these are the things that, and again, these are all my own words. In terms of the way I'm describing his language in here, I use no quotes, and everything that he talks about, I completely have thought about in my own ways already, so I don't have to use his words. I just jotted notes about the specific points that he's trying to make from the few chapters that are there, seven chapters or whatever it is. It's very short, again, only 57 pages, easily digestible by anybody. And there's some footnotes and things, and there's references to other people, and so that's always great. He gets in there and he talks about how the state is an organization of a small group of people that use the monopoly on force and violence under law, right, in their particular territory, in their jurisdiction. They use the force of law to ultimately rob the population that's under their territory and under their control to fund it and themselves, the political, those who benefit from the those who are in the political class who benefit directly from the redistribution of wealth, ultimately. And he talks briefly about then the nature of individual wealth and how it's created and best exchanged voluntarily with other people, and that doing so is how we ultimately avoid conflict through that mutually beneficial exchanges, and that what we seek through the law, what we sought through the law, is to been to resolve those disputes so that we don't have to constantly battle with our neighbors like it's feudal times. He mentions Franz Oppenheimer, and I think I know the name, but I didn't know him. That should not surprise you at all. It's not my thing. I don't know how many home runs Babe Ruth had, and I don't know what Franz Oppenheimer had to say about economics. I didn't need his opinion on it. I practice it every day from as long as I can. Certainly, by the time I'm recognizing it in my early teens, in my early formative years as things. And I've had a couple of people by that point come up to me, one particular person in general. Specifically, there you go. It was Ken Riggs, of course, number seven or something like that of the Libertarian Party. Grew up right there in Colorado where the Libertarian Party was formed. Ran into him at the age of 10, I suppose, through church and going to church. And by the time I was 12, I knew what the Federal Reserve was. I knew what Federal Reserve notes were. I knew the difference between gold and currency. And so all these other things about the nature of how trade works were really simple, easy things to follow once you explain the nature of the instruments used to conduct trade. It's really easy to figure out what it is. But I didn't know who Franz was, and that's not a slight on Franz at all. Not in any way, shape, or form. It's just me. He said there were two ways to acquire wealth. One was to create them basically through voluntary exchanges or steal it. And he called the former the economic means and the latter the political means of doing this. And he does make Rothbard. At this point, he makes a statement. I made a specific note about this that I'm not entirely convinced that I agree with, and that should make most people happy, that I'm not absolutely just swallowing this whole thing. That's a good quality to have in somebody who is, we'll say, conducting an anarchist audit of an idea and somebody's work. Well, yeah, the idea that I would accept it wholly without investigating it is ridiculous. That's why we're having this conversation. That's why we're talking about the book. So he makes this statement. He says he calls economics the economic way, that the economic means versus the political means. He calls the economic the natural way. I would absolutely argue that that's fine. That's perfectly true. But he suggests that the political way isn't natural. And that's where I kind of beg to differ, because I think it's entirely within our nature to take what we want from others. Animals do it. We're animals. It's an effort to recognize that it's not moral. It's an effort to go against your nature, what is natural, to create an ideology and a system that functions alongside the best portion of nature and our own nature as man to be able to conduct business with each other. Because the reason I say why is because he makes this assertion calling the political method parasitic, and there are plenty of examples parasitic in life where parasites, there it's a mutually beneficial relationship, that the parasitic relationship, that the parasite doesn't want to kill the host, that is not what it's there for, that its best option is to keep the parasite alive because it's, you know, not necessarily mutually beneficial, but it's certainly, if the parasite kills its host, then it dies too, generally speaking. And so there's an argument there that it's completely natural, that parasitism, being a parasite, is completely natural. And so that looking at it that way may or may not make a difference, but I think that there's some balance there within nature that says that it's not unnatural, but that it's our nature as humans, as in being in control of ourselves, being in control of our nature, attempting to make a society, attempting to create things as opposed to destroy things, you find a tool, a system, an ideology that works, and free exchange absolutely works better than the parasitic nature of many relationships. In our children are a parasitic relationship. In the womb, they're a parasite feeding off the mother, and it wouldn't want to kill it because it would die, until it's viable. But even then, it's not viable, and so it doesn't kill mama. It's still parasitic. It still lives off of mama. Sometimes it lives off of her breast. Sometimes it just lives off of her wallet it has its own agency to go out on its own and take care of itself. And it's an acceptable parasitic relationship because we realize that there's a benefit, generally speaking. We get a benefit from raising our children. We get a greater view of the world and understanding of ourselves and all these things that come from having children, raising them, seeing them grow up, seeing them become happy, realizing your ideals and the things that you've grown up with and understand have been properly passed on, and that they're going to be good people. That's what all I work for. So the parasitic is natural, but the moral distinction, I think, is what's more important. That's what separates the men and women who want to build, and everything in between, who want to build a society As opposed to those who want to try to thrive off it and shape it, the politics, the political class, those guys. I don't argue with him at all on the damage the political method, the parasitic method can do to the host. I'm just saying that it's probably just as natural. And so that brings me back to the nature of the state to answer the question of what the state is, right? Obviously, that's where he's headed. It must be the next chapter, and it is. What is what the state is? And he goes to a couple of people, and he uses some of his own language, and this is my own language here. That it's an organization that provides a legal means through which some of the people are able to survive as parasites in control over a legal jurisdiction. These are all words. These are all things that we've discussed over the years that we should have an understanding of what I mean by them. So I'm not going to beleaguer that point. Nothing I haven't said before, truly. Absolutely nothing I haven't said before. In fact, I think I summed it up in a lot less words every time I've talked about it than were even used in the sort of 57-page pamphlet there. I always am trying to consider how to simplify my language. That's the whole point of it. I don't need action. I don't need human action. I don't need that entire tome to explain to someone what's moral and right and what's different about control versus voluntary existence. It's obvious. It's self-evident. And apparently, there's a lot of people that do. They really need it. They really need that. They need that clarity to convey the message of the nature of the state. Some of them do. I try to minimize it. I try to make it as simple as possible. Sometimes people think that's an oversimplification. I don't think it is. I don't think you can oversimplify breaking things down into fact by fact as long as it's still a fact. And once you get to the point of conjecture, then you're wasting your time. And speaking of the wasting time, Candace Owens and Andrew Wilson, they did it earlier today. They had the conversation. I watched a little bit. It's been a fun exchange. I'm not a huge fan of either. I know of them. Again, haven't spent a lot of time listening to either of them, so can't call myself a fan. I've heard a comment here, a thing there by them that lends me to believe that sometimes they're right about the important things, the individual and the economics of things, and the attempts at control by whoever and whomever. So apparently then there's this social contract thing that goes way back, because he mentions it. It comes up. It's quoted. It's used there. He says that the state has never been created by a social contract, only by legal plunder through theft. And obviously that's something that we talk about all the time. People argue that America, that democracy, that ended that. But then that's the Constitution. These are these conversations that you and I have had even a little bit here recently, in talking about the fact that the Constitution is a contract. Well, it's not. It's clearly not a contract. We know it's not. We've broken down what a contract is. You don't even have to break down what a contract is to look at the Constitution and know that it's not a contract, because it doesn't confer anything to anyone. It doesn't transfer ownership of an idea. It doesn't involve more than one party. All the people who signed the Constitution, signed off on the Constitution, they were all on the same side of the argument. Do you get that? Do you not understand that? So it can't be a contract. A contract is a multiple-party document. There's not even two parties, if you will, involved in the creation of the Constitution. It's not a contract in any way, shape, or form. We know that. And you know also my explanation of America's founding as a corporate action allowed by the Crown, allowed by Britain, that the Constitution is literally the Articles of Incorporation. It's the exact same thing. Some friends would get together. They're all on the same side of the argument, even though they're writing a constitution that sort of delineates their separation from the rules that they're setting up and each other's differences. They're agreeing to this certain subset of things to work under. Everything else outside of that is up for grabs and up for debate. And then, of course, they have to come along and they attached on the thing about the people. They set up their corporation, and then they said, oh, well, within the corporation's boundaries, within America's boundaries and its jurisdiction and its it's legal jurisdiction, it's corporate jurisdiction, you will have these rights, and they will be supposedly protected by the state. We understand this already. And so that truly this is what gets to the point where everyone realizes that all that needs to happen is that a bandit, some group of bandits, thieves, marauders, whatever they are, hold the territory long enough to establish themselves as the ruling class, as a king or whatever, and then legalize their plunder. It becomes normalized. It's accepted. It's accepted as a necessary evil. That's one of the things he goes on about early in it, is how people just accept that government is what it is, and that they assume that it must be necessary, and that because we participate, that it's okay what government does, generally speaking. And I really love how he talks about how the state maintains power through the apparent majority consensus that we're all involved in this thing, because and how the state doesn't require active participation or your acceptance, at most just an ambivalence that allows it to continue. I've likened it to going to a football game or watching a football game. They don't really care if you in particular show up at the stands and in the stands and buy a ticket and root, just as long as somebody does, as long as it's the thing that people are willing to do. You don't have to do it. You don't have to accept it. As long as enough of the people to legitimize what they're doing, to pay for what they're doing without it becoming a revolt, ultimately, it's very similar. They don't need you there, particularly all the people out there that don't contribute directly to the dollars that go to the NFL. You don't necessarily buy the jerseys. That's me. I don't necessarily buy the jerseys. I watch some of the games every once in a while, but I don't have the hats. I don't buy the gear. These are not things that I participate in at all. And there are many people out there that don't, and they'll never get those extra dollars from me. And so the state, though, can make anybody in its jurisdiction. Once you go into the stadium, you're in their jurisdiction, and they're going to charge you $35 for a beer. They're going to do all the things that they do in their venue and in their space, and you're going to take it or you're going to leave. The state isn't like that, not necessarily. Certainly if you get out of that state's boundaries, but then what if the state encroaches upon the boundaries that you just crossed to get out of that state? Well, that's supposedly our 50 countries that make up the nation of America were supposed to be ruled over this central authority, this commercial authority, and the Constitution guaranteeing that if you cross from one to another, they'd protect your general rights. It's a very interesting thing. It really proves that like where democracy comes in real handy. And as I said a little bit ago, it's how the ideology matters. That's what matters. It's the idea of democracy. And of course, that's what we know that the state, the Leviathan, feeds on. The system is true. The failure is the people. Well, it isn't our system or a system of the people, is it really? Or is it? Which is it? Come on. Can we make up this? The system is true, but it's a failure of the people. But the system is of the people? Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense, right? Back to the quote that the greater danger to the state is the independent intellectual criticism. That's an actual quote, because he goes on to talk about how the state will then co-opt intellectualism, how it'll co-opt intellectuals, and how it'll push the idea that the state is moral and correct and always the right choice, regardless of the current state of the state, right? Whoever's in charge of it doesn't really matter, that it's the state. It's the ideology that's so much more important, and that through participation allowed by the state, we can trust the state to accept it all, right? I was saying the other day, and sort of totally unrelated to this audit at all, or my reading of the anatomy of the state. It was 4 or 5 days ago before I sat down and did. I did this morning and put my notes down. I said across social media, just a post I made, maybe a great, you know, not the greatest statement ever made about anything, but certainly expressing these ideas with them already in my head. And I just said how most people, they seem to have a problem with political authority, but only when they disagree with a particular person or the party. And so the abuses of people, of right, of the system itself, of its own rules, they're attributed to the individual action or party politics. And the majority of people seem to fail to realize that the system is the actual problem, that it's the problem. Not those actors within the system, that if the system wasn't what it was, that those actors couldn't have acted the way they did within the system to do what they did. The system allowed or it failed to prevent these politicians and the people who benefit from them being in office from weaponizing what was already an extremely simultaneously dangerous system and a precarious one, because it's built on a fallacy. It's built on a fallacy that you can vote, that and that a majority vote is okay, and that ultimately the majority of vote is whether it's the majority that participates or not, but whatever the winning vote is, that it's okay to go forward with that. That if it's 51 people telling 49 other people how to do it, that's fantastic. But it's not even better at 70-30, and it's worse the closer you get to 99-1, isn't it? Right? Why should 99 people be able to tell one guy he can't do something, particularly if it's none of their business, it doesn't have anything to do with them, wouldn't harm them, doesn't harm them, isn't otherwise really an action against one of them? It doesn't do anything. It's none of their business. This system is supposedly built by and for the people, but it's completely weaponized against them. And really, truly, besides, if this system is so great, if it's really that great, the pooling of the money, the redistribution of the wealth, the controls, the manipulations, if it was all so great, wouldn't they have at least stumbled back asswards into solving at least one thing by now? Just one thing? Anything? I don't even care what it is, homelessness, drugs, immigration, corporate greed, just one thing, fatty foods and sugary drinks, please, for the love of God, fix it and make it so I don't have those things anymore and I'm not tempted and I don't voluntarily suck those things down into my gullet and it gets, and watch my belly get bigger. After he's talking about this, I immediately thought about the whole Elon Musk thing. Remember how he was all buddy-buddy with the administration and they were doing all these things and auditing this and that and the other thing? But as soon as the narrative changed to go against the system that was in control, whether it was the entirety of the system or not, but it was really the entirety of the system, right? The Democrats already didn't like him. Republicans were leery of him. And then he made the president mad and now they're not buddy-buddy anymore. How was it all... that's that support, right, for or the manipulation of the intellectuals. He and all of his people were supported, the intellectuals he represented there, until the point that they didn't go along with it anymore, right? The whims of the current controllers of the state, he said he didn't buy it anymore, and so they bounced him out. He was given money and protection and favor, and it was all good until he didn't go along with what the controllers of the current state, the state of the state, and their agenda. And remember before that how he was a darling of the left and is saving the planet and these things, and he's a technological advancer, and he's going to make all this greatness. And then when he became MAGA, it switched, and they started hating him. And then now the MAGAs hated him. And now he's buddy-buddy again. Apparently they repaired their relationship, and they're all buddy-buddy again. Of course, they benefit each other. Cui bono? Who benefits? They benefit. And we don't. We don't matter. It does not matter if we participate. It does not matter if you participate. It does not matter if I participate. It doesn't matter how many of us participate. They're going to continue to do the things that they want to do. And they haven't solved a thing. They haven't fixed a single thing. But that right there, I think the whole Elon thing is a really great example of exactly what he's talking about, that at that point in the book, how the intellectuals are captured and how they benefit from it and how they'll go along with the party. And it's all fine and dandy. It's all fine and dandy until somebody says, no, that's not the way we do things around here. You either get in line or you get out. And that kind of happened. At this point, Rothbard gives us some more examples of the want of authoritarian controls and dictates for the purpose of sort of Orwellian type alterations of history for the benefit of democracy. It's a really interesting thing that I think you could follow down a whole other path. But just talking about how the state retains power and the various things that it goes through to retain power and the methods that it uses, and one of those key methods to retain power is to demonize and denigrate other states or theories of coexistence, anarchism or socialism while being socialist. That's one of the great ones. Communist while being communist, realizing that the end of socialism is communism and that socialism would have to steal all of the capital from capitalism, take all of that wealth and use it for itself to institute its communist theory. I've never read Marx, but that's the basics of it, right? That's exactly what they're talking about. That's what they want to do. That's what they believe that socialism leads to, is their completely supposedly community state, because it's in the word commune, communism, but it's not. It's centralized. It's total centralized control over the political and economic and social, because we'll get into that, how one of the things that is that they manage to grab power. He talks about it in separate ways and brings up some things about the separation of sort of political versus social ends. And, well, obviously those things have met. Those things have come together in a massive attack against individualism and the social aspects and the social groups have attempted to and have been relatively successful. Certainly if you talk about religious social groups in the current administration and view of control over our system, it's obvious that a certain line of thinking has taken control and is able to do that, and how they're able to do that. So this isn't that long ago necessarily, in terms of our reality and our understanding of the way these things work, both economics and government, but far enough back that there's not these couple of perfect examples in our own time. That basically he's sitting here telling you that we're going to be where we are today if we don't do something different economically, socially, politically. And yeah, here we are. And people like myself, 20 plus years, almost 30 years now, I guess, under my belt of openly talking about these things in a public forum, on my platform, across radio, everywhere that I could be heard, obviously across the internet and across the wonderful Republic Broadcasting Network, who you should support. You should go to Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. That's what the home of Republic Broadcasting Network. You'll see the new website. It's looking really good as they're right in the middle of changes. Some things look a little weird, but they're right in the middle of some changes, and you can still make a donation to support the network. And I donate myself regularly to the network, and not even for my own means. And I'm on a regular donation now, not even just I was dropping $100 here or something like that. I'm on a regular donation now. So I put my money where my mouth is, because I believe that the network here provides a place where you can have the conversation, and I'm proof of it. Because there's not any reason why the network in and of itself, or necessarily its core audience, should or would have me there, save for a couple of people that I've become familiar with digitally over the last decade plus, and have, they understand that my conversation isn't incompatible with their listeners across the network, and it's an amazing thing. And you guys support the network and have for years, and it's a home. I can do this anytime, any place I want to. I'm an example of being able to use use a little bit of information, a little bit of knowledge, and a little bit of skill to be able to have a huge impact without having to pay other people to do it, to be stuck inside the confines of one person or another or one group or another's dictates about what you can talk about and what you can say. I don't have any of those problems. You can't cancel me. But I don't have to question that across the network. I'm there because they believe that it's a space to have the conversation, and I'm lucky to be a part of it. All right, so speaking of the network, we're going into hour two of this, and I'll continue the conversation. It's Anatomy of the State. It's my anarchist audit of it, Murray Rothbard's Anatomy of the State. And for the rest of you, you'll have to just look for the second part of it if it's wrapping. Hopefully it'll be linked to whatever you're listening to. But if it's not, it's there at towardanarchy.com for sure. And we'll be right back here on the network. And we'll see you on the second half if you're not here on the network. It's coming right up.
You're listening to Toward Anarchy on the Republic Broadcasting Network.